Welcome to the October 2015 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This activity is certified for 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The date of original release for this issue is October 2015. The expiration date is September 2018. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to identify the steps in treatment and management of patients with dysesthesia, including prescribing, educating patients, empathizing with suffering, and setting realistic treatment goals. Recognize how stress and the nervous system may exacerbate inflammatory dermatoses, and recognize treatment options for pigmentation disorders. Contributors to this issue of Dialogues in Dermatology have disclosed the following financial relationships. Dr. Stuart Brown has been a stockholder and received stock from Johnson & Johnson Consumer Products Company and Pfizer, Inc. Dr. Richard Granstein has been a consultant for and received fees from Galderma Laboratories, LP, has been a consultant for and received no compensation from Colatan Pharmaceutical, Inc., and has served on the advisory board and received no compensation from Velius, LLC. Dr. Simal Desai has been the principal investigator for and received grants and research funding from AbbVie, MERS Pharmaceuticals, LLC, and Tolmar, has been a consultant for and received fees from AbbVie, Allergan, Inc., Anacor Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Galderma Laboratories, LP, and Valiant Pharmaceuticals, North America, LLC. Has served on the advisory board and received honoraria from Galderma Laboratories, LP, and has been a speaker and received honoraria from Valiant Pharmaceuticals, North America, LLC. Dr. Richard Fried has been a speaker and received honoraria from Allergan, Inc., Centocor Ortho Biotech, Inc., and Galderma Laboratories, LP. Has been a speaker and received no compensation from Coria Laboratories, has served on the advisory board and received honoraria from Johnson & Johnson Consumer Product Company, has been a consultant and received honoraria from Stiefel, a GSK company, has been a speaker and received honoraria from Valiant Pharmaceuticals North America, LLC, and has been a principal investigator and received honoraria from Valiant Pharmaceuticals North America, LLC. A comprehensive list of financial relationships with commercial interests reported by all other editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff is available in the syllabus.
Greetings. This is Terry Cronin from Melbourne, Florida, and as your editor-in-chief, I want to welcome you to this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology for October 2015, Volume 71, Issue 10. This is a multimedia digest sponsored by the American Academy of Dermatology. Remember to download the fabulous new Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone and computer. This convenient app is making dialogues even more accessible and enjoyable while effectively providing CMEs for you. In this month's edition, we have three new dialogues involving dysesthesias, stress, and pigmentation. Psychocutaneous morbidity is ubiquitous in our dermatology practices. A dysesthesia is defined as any unpleasant or abnormal sensation, either spontaneous or evoked. Most cases of dysesthesia encompass features of both organic and psychogenic etiologies. As a result, proper treatment requires clinical consideration and evaluation in both realms. In this dialogue, Dr. Stephen Sciama and Dr. Richard Fried, who is both a dermatologist and clinical psychologist, discuss the problem of dysesthesia, which can be a deceptive and often devastating disorder.
This is Dr. Steve Sciama. It's my pleasure to interview Richard Fried. He has an MD and a PhD. He's a dermatologist. He's also a clinical psychologist. He's the clinical director of the Yardley Dermatology Associates and also the Yardley Clinical Research Associates. Rick, thank you very much for talking to me on Dialogues.
Steve, pleasure to be here.
Can we begin with just the definition of dysesthesias and then separate it up from the other esthesias that we know about, like paresthesias?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think for so many of us, when we think about alteration in skin sensation, we tend to think of pain or itch. But there's really a much broader spectrum than that. And dysesthesia, by definition, is any uncomfortable sensation in the skin. What differentiates dysesthesia from so many of the other entities like hyperesthesia or hypoesthesia is that the dysesthesia can be absolutely spontaneous in nature. It's not necessarily elicited by outside forces. It's just this miserable sensation that can include itch, tingle, burning, pain, crawling, biting. any sensation you can imagine. Whereas the hypoesthesia, yes, when we touch them, they feel the sensation less. The hyperesthesia, when we touch them, they feel it more. But the dysesthesia just seems to have a mind of its own.
So it's spontaneous, and it can be elicited too. In other words, if I touch someone with a dysesthesia, they might say, I feel it, and it's painful. And I said, I just touch it very lightly. So it's out of proportion and different than I would have expected. Is that part of it too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They can coexist, and it can be an exaggerated reaction to normal touch. Or the sensory exam, the typical sensory exam, can be totally normal, but they are just absolutely devastated by the chronicity of the dysesthesias.
Okay, I want to ask you a question, because everyone knows you have a PhD in psychology and you're a clinical psychologist, so immediately most of us, and myself included, are saying this is all in someone's mind, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
I honestly believe that the majority of dysesthesias are organic in nature. Whether we can actually document them by skin biopsy, by functional MRI, sometimes we can, sometimes we can't. The other issue is, with chronicity, whether the dysesthesia began as an allergic contact dermatitis, an infestation, or it began as a fear of infection, with chronicity, I think there's an overlap where they become both organic and psychogenic in nature. You know, when someone says, my skin feels funny, it's really not terribly funny, because when there's an alteration in sensation with no good reason for it, people begin to become exceedingly anxious about why? And do I have an infection? Do I have cancer? Do I have AIDS? And the more terrified they become, the more focused they become on the negative sensation. That intensifies the sensation. The anxiety leads to more and more intensification, and it becomes a vicious cycle that honestly can begin to own the person, or in the extreme, actually lead them to total dysfunction and suicidal ideation or frank suicide.
Where's the pathology? Show me where it is, or I have to find it. If I can't find it, then I have to look, is it perceived? But these people are in pain. Something is going on with them. And our job is to find out if there's something organically going on. Now, let's take the organic, and then we'll deal with the psychology after that. What could have set something off? Let's do someone who comes in perhaps with a groin itch. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely.
Right? And there's no pathology, but there's a history of perhaps some pathology.
Right. If you use the analogy there of a postherpetic neuralgia.
Okay.
After there's been a groin inflammation, be it a frank tinea pedis, chronic intertrigo, the threshold of firing for the C fibers and other cutaneous elements lowers. So they may inappropriately fire at the neuronal level. They may inappropriately release neuropeptide, substance P, calcitonin-gene reactive peptide. So their threshold may be just so much lower that they're experiencing these chronic sensations, if you will, the as-if sensations, as if something is still going on.
All right, so let me go over this again. I'm seeing a guy who has a groin itch, and he tells me that he's been seeing a lot of other people. Some of them made it contact dermatitis kind of thing. He modified his underwear, his detergent and whatnot. Some people said he had tinea cruris, and they gave him some antifungals, and things got better, but he said they're not better, and I've been recommended to see you because I know you're a contact person like myself. And I'm saying, I don't see anything over here. So I put him through patch tests, I find nothing. And then I'm saying, am I dealing with a dysesthesia?
Mm-hmm. Is that
what may be happening over here?
Absolutely. And okay. Perhaps the autosensitization reaction, or the ID, post-allergic contact dermatitis, is analogous again, where you have activated T cells that continue to behave as if.
So, you know, let's assume you've cleared things up and someone is still complaining of symptoms. How long can they complain about it until you say, you know what, I'm dealing with a dysesthesia here. It's not real pathology in the organic way, but there's a psychological mechanism of here. Can it go on for 3 weeks, 6 months? And at 6 months, you just say, aha, now I don't have to work up this person anymore. I can just switch him to someone like Rick here and let him take over.
Right. The dysesthesias can last 3 months, 3 years. When it becomes meaningful is when it's a symptom that just will not abate, does not respond to traditional therapy, and is causing them a degree of psychological distress. Yet one of the important questions with the dysesthesia is the symptom existing in isolation, or is a symptom accompanied by behaviors on the part of the owner? Often because of fears and beliefs about what's causing it, we find people are over-medicating, people are sometimes scratching, people are sometimes digging, people are sometimes using all kinds of herbals. So there's sometimes secondary exacerbation from anything from friction to allergic contact dermatitis to just frank skin excoriation. So how they feel about how they feel is a big deal. And by the time we see them, often we have to go through that differential diagnosis. And frankly, from my point of view, any chronic dysesthesia is a paraneoplastic presentation until proven otherwise. Any chronic dysesthesia is a metabolic, infectious, or autoimmune until proven otherwise. And it's not good enough to prove it once. Months have a way of piling by, as we all know. If they, at 6 months, are still with the same symptoms, if they've had serologic studies, imaging studies, they need to be repeated.
You have to revisit these people and maybe even re-biopsy things that
absolutely.
You biopsied before?
I had a gentleman sent to me several years ago who was sent by his primary care doctor as being, in quotes, a total nut, unquote. In fact, he was a nervous wreck, rambling speech, pressured speech, really a mess to try to get him focused. He said he had intractable itch, burning and biting, had a kind of colored and storied past in terms of some of his extramarital behaviors. And when I examined him, I didn't see much except for excoriations, did a skin biopsy. Basically, it just showed nonspecific excoriations, a couple of lymphocytes. 6 months later, biopsied him again, a couple of atypical lymphocytes. 6 months later, frank CTCL. So the question is, was this a crazy guy, in quotes, who developed CTCL, or was his itch from day one a presentation of his underlying malignancy? So our obligation is to remain vigilant. And I think perhaps the most important thing, when these patients come in, again, they're terrified. They've had complete control ripped away from them. They cannot control, predict, or understand their symptoms. So the approach, I think, that is very helpful with every patient with dysesthesias is a promise. And the promise is, I promise you, we will remain incredibly vigilant in a search for anything underlying that's causing this, whether it's an infection, whether it's an infestation, frankly, whether it's some kind of cancer. We will never stop watching. The second part of it is to help them understand that something has become different about their nerve endings. Their nerve endings are inappropriately firing and giving these awful sensations. And nerve endings have a limited repertoire when they fire. It can be itch, tingle, burn, pain, mm-hmm. crawl. So our job is to normalize the responsivity of their nerve endings. And we're going to do that using sometimes creams, sometimes lotions, sometimes pills. Crucial is that we tell them we're not going to suppress or shut off those nerve endings. Because deep in their heart, they're terrified. If you shut those nerve endings off, they're not going to tell me. They're not going to signal me when that big bad bear may come out. So I tell them we're going to normalize the nerve endings so they respond appropriately when they need to, when they should, but not inappropriately, making you miserable. We can give you your life back. We can give you your normal routine back. And again, stay absolutely on guard.
Here's a story. I'm someone who comes in. I have localized itching versus generalized itching. Different kind of concern. Let's assume groin. Where are the areas that you most likely will find someone with dysesthesias presenting?
Great question. I think groin is probably perhaps number one. Face, very common. Hands and feet, very common. And the scalp as well. And I'm glad you brought that up because certain areas have terrifically symbolic significance to people. There's an article I wrote last year called Vagus Dysesthesia, What Happens There Stays Where. And many of us have had the occasion of having a male patient come in with chronic groin itch or tingle or burn, convinced they've contracted something, and at some later date confess, you know, I was in Vegas and I had a contact that I was terrified about, and scrubbed and rubbed an out damn spot, and these symptoms continued. So for that individual, they are terrified that they've caught something, perhaps because of chance, perhaps because of some attribution from a power above. But nonetheless, they need, A, a workup to make sure they did not, in fact, contract an STD. B, they need to stop overwashing, overcleansing, overscrubbing, and then C, they need appropriate medicaments. On the face, people are terrified on the face that it's going to change their appearance, perhaps become destructive and disfiguring. So the locations have a lot of emotional significance for many, many people. The stronger the emotional reaction, the more intensified the dysesthesia often becomes. So frankly, we've got to treat three things. We've got to treat the sensation. Ideally, if we can find the cause, treat the cause of the sensation. Then we have to treat the emotional concomitant or response, which in some people is depression, in some people it's anxiety, in some people it's OCD. Alcoholics Anonymous has a wonderful expression. Any thought nurtured long enough becomes an obsession. And unquestionably, dysesthesias lead to obsessive perseveration. And that's what we've got to take a multifaceted approach.
You know, you've made me feel like I'm not crazy. If I were the patient, that this is something that happens to people, and I'm not just imagining it, it is real in some way, shape, or form. I think that's very, very important.
I think you hit the nail just precisely on the head. And these are people who have dismissed as being nuts.
Yeah.
They can't sleep. They can't function. They're becoming convinced they're nuts.
Now, are there drugs or things like that that can set this off to make it easy for me? Like if I'm an alcoholic and stopping drinking, or if I'm stopping taking medications or taking medications, can some of these things in your review of history say, you know what, let's see if this is going to get by with this and this?
Absolutely. Drugs, bugs, food, and maybe prescription drugs. With the amount of opiates that people are on these days, it might be recreational drug use.
Mm-hmm.
As all of us know, many, many common street drugs, be they marijuana or others, are laced with things that can be enormously itchogenic. Withdrawal from alcohol. Herbals. Some of the herbals we see, certainly drug reactions and chronic itching. Anything that crosses our lips is no question.
Yeah, I'm sensing, Rick, that this is an end-of-the-day patient for you. In other words, you don't want to get behind. You want to really take your time with them the first time you see them, and in fact, the second and third times.
Ideally, they are end-of-the-day patients.
Yeah.
Do they end up being so? No. One can argue
The
dysesthetic patient, whether they're the patient with delusions of parasitosis or the patient with chronic burning, may perhaps be easier than the cosmetic patient with 8.5 by 11 list of complaints and concerns. But I think once we get the message across to these patients, as you articulated so well, that there is a biological basis, and we have treated hundreds of people, and we have the tools. And the tools can be in the form of topicals, anything from topical corticosteroids, topical calcineurin inhibitors, topical amitriptyline cream or lotion, topical doxepin, many of these symptom sensation altering things, whether it's sarna, whether it's any of the other menthol based products, sometimes cold applications. So we have a wonderful collection of topicals. If that doesn't do it, certainly many people by the time they see us have tried antihistamines, both sedating and non-sedating, sometimes adding an H2 blocker on board, if there's a histamine component to the itch, can be very, very beneficial. Cyproheptadine can be very beneficial if there's itch and histamine at work. Moving into some of the, in quotes, psychiatric medicines, the tricyclic antidepressants. Classically, doxepin we've all used, and you know, we kid ourselves as dermatologists when we say, you know, we don't like to prescribe psychotropic medicines. Frankly, if you look at the pharmacologic structure of Benadryl, it's not far from Thorazine. Doxepin, clearly, we say, oh, we only use it in lower dose. It's a tricyclic antidepressant, and the TCAs are beautiful at inhibiting histamine release and in modulating some of the emotional response. Amitriptyline, particularly for scalp dysesthesias, remains one of the drugs of choice. Dosages, we tend to use lower dosages than we do for psychological conditions. For doxepin, 10 to 25 to 50 to 100. For amitriptyline, we're talking about, again, starting at low dosing at 10 milligrams, titrating up to the 100 to 150 milligrams as needed. The newer generations, the SSRIs, be they fluoxetine, paroxetine, sertraline, I honestly don't believe there's a SSRI of choice that you can look at a given individual and say Jim Jones is going to do well with sertraline versus Sandy who's going to do well with paroxetine. I think it's a matter of starting low, going slow, much as many of us do with isotretinoin. But nonetheless, the SSRI can be exceedingly helpful for obsessive ideation, for the anxiety, and for the depressive symptoms. For the tougher players, the SNRIs, medicines like venlafaxine, 50 to 300 milligrams. The SNRIs, as you know, cover both serotonin and norepinephrine.
Okay, I was going to ask you what the SSNRs were. Okay.
And norepinephrine, for some people, play a larger role, or at least an equal role. We know that the inflammation that is in the skin, from chronically excoriated skin, from primary inflammatory skin disease, we learned in 2010 that those inflammatory mediators don't just stay in the skin, they cross the blood-brain barrier. When they enter the brain, what they do is they enhance reuptake of neuropeptides. So they actually lower neurotransmitter levels at the synapse. So the secondary diminution of neurotransmitters, again, makes people more anxious, more depressed, more distressed, and intensify the symptom. So normalizing some of those levels at the level of the synapse, important.
I think one of the biggest things you're talking about, Rick, in the dialogue today is that they're not necessarily crazy, although you can label them as that easily and dismiss them, and you have to have a heart and you have to have plenty of time. Let me ask you a couple of closing responses over here. Number one, one of the biggest things, I suppose, is to tell someone, I don't believe you're crazy, and there is a place for you in the way I think, and that this will get better. I can't guarantee it, but it will get better.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely.
Those are the two things I think, when reading your very good article that you made reference to, is that correct? That was the vagal?
Yes, yes. And letting them know that you strongly do not feel they're crazy, even though, my God, if I were living with these symptoms, I would begin to wonder, am I crazy? So I'm sure at times you feel that way, but you have a right to. And we have the tools to fix this. As a psychologist, I am a control freak. I don't want to control anyone. I want to give it to people. Uh-huh. And I think if we look across the spectrum of what we do on a daily basis as dermatologists, whether it's psoriasis, eczema, rosacea, whether it's skin cancer, whether it's dysesthesia, we're in the business of giving people an enhanced sense of control over their skin, over their body, and ultimately over their emotional reaction.
Yeah, I'm reading something that you said, and maybe you can continue this. Never assume that they're crazy, but also never assume that the crazy person can't be sick, and be ever vigilant in terms of your evaluation of these people.
Absolutely.
Now, these are your words. I want to give everyone.
Yeah. There's an old joke about the hypochondriac. On his tombstone, it says, I told you I was sick. So, yes, even crazy people do get sick. And delusions of parasitosis, very quickly. This is the patient that nobody wants to take care of. Let's just ship them off. There are two groups of delusions of parasitosis. There are the delusional patients who truly believe that they are infested with bugs. They'll tell you about them. They see them. They'll tell you about their mating habits. Then there are the delusions of parasitosis, in quotes, patient, who have horrible biting sensations. God forbid anyone listening to this wakes up tomorrow morning with biting, crawling sensations on their skin. Their attribution is going to be, I've got bugs. So sometimes it's pure neuropathic, sometimes it's pure psychogenic, but it always becomes both. With pickers, do people pick because their skin itches, tingles, hurts, or burns, or do they pick it because they're what they do? There's an article written recently that I wrote on skin pickers. Could skin picking, neurotic excoriations, be a form thrust of Tourette's disorder? 1 milligram of pimazide often shuts these people down. Quantify the sensation. Tell them to please let you know exactly what they feel, and then what do they do in response to it? If they rub it, pick it, ask them, are you always picking or rubbing in response to the sensation, or is it kind of just what you do? And for a lot of people, they'll say, you know what? It's kind of what I do. For those people with functionally autonomous scratch and pick, sometimes pimazide at ridiculously low dose, SSRIs, can literally just melt it away. And they'll come back in and say, you know, it's a funny thing. I'm just not feeling it, and I'm just not there as much anymore.
Yeah, okay. And never give up on them, and always be vigilant. If something isn't getting better, we'll re-biopsy, reevaluate, and spend enough time with them.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
This has been very, very wonderful, Rick. I thank you very much. I hope people have gotten, listeners, as much as I've gotten out of this. I know you care very much, and I think many of the messages that we as physicians have to give, especially as dermatologists, when someone comes in being labeled by other people as kind of weird and crazy, is to say, I don't believe that's what's happening, and I'll do the best I can to make you better.
And Steve, you and I passionately believe we can heal. We do. We meaning you and I, we meaning every clinician out there. And it's a grateful privilege because these are the kind of patients that, my God, when you improve their symptoms, it's literally giving their life back.
Yeah. Rick, thanks very much for the time. A pleasure.
Thank you. Same here.
Dr. Fried believes that the majority of dysesthesias are organic in nature, or at least have an organic component. Identifying a biological basis for the abnormal sensation is one of the greatest challenges in managing cases, but remains essential before the consideration of purely psychogenic causes. When evaluating a patient with dysesthesia, Dr. Fried considers a, quote, perineoplastic phenomenon until proven otherwise, end quote, in order to rule out the most dangerous possible causes. He also emphasizes the value of repeating microscopic, serologic, and imaging studies in order to sort out metabolic, infectious, and autoimmune etiologies. For example, degenerative disc disease and the ensuing entrapment of nerve roots is often the underlying cause of notalgia paresthetica and scalp dysesthesia. A thorough medical exam and biopsy may identify an underlying disease of another organ system manifesting on the skin, sometimes as a novel target organ. Dysesthesia may also represent a somatic remnant of previous pathology, such as in the case of postherpetic neuralgia, trigeminal trophic syndrome, or other analogous conditions. Dr. Fried implicates lower thresholds of excitability for C fibers after an inflammatory insult, allowing these nerves to inappropriately release nociceptive substances. Despite the interplay between organic and psychogenic causes of dysesthesia, traditionally psychiatric treatment modalities are often effective for this distressing condition regardless of the cause. Tricyclic antidepressants such as amitriptyline and doxepin antagonize receptors beyond their targets such as H1 and H2 histamine receptors, leading to a dampening of a pruritic dysesthesia. A pruritic dysesthesia may represent a somatic manifestation of an obsession, which is then compulsively excoriated by the patient. Dr. Fried notes that a mere 1 mg of pimazide can attenuate compulsion and thus dampen the dysesthesia. Although no specific time period defines dysesthesia, Dr. Fried explains that the universally chronic nature of this condition is a major issue. Numerous and lengthy office visits are often followed by multiple therapeutic trials, many of which fail before an effective treatment is identified. Patients are often left hopeless for a functional life, and this increased anxiety over the chronicity of symptoms only amplifies the persistent, distressing sensations. In these challenging cases, Dr. Fried and Dr. Sharma discuss the importance of developing a supportive alliance with the patient. In order to develop a fruitful therapeutic relationship, physicians should be open to non-pharmacological therapies such as biofeedback, cognitive behavioral therapy, and medical hypnotherapy, all of which have demonstrated effectiveness in patients suffering from dysesthesia. Educating patients, empathizing with their suffering, and setting realistic goals for treatment are therapeutic steps that are equally important and should complement pharmacologic therapy. Ultimately, the most effective treatment methodology of dysesthesia includes a multi-pronged approach incorporating treatment of the sensation, the cause of the sensation, and the emotional response.